Hi, Dave Emery here, side one of For the Record program number 803, Walking the Snake in Ukraine. This is being recorded on July 27th of the year 2014. This is the 11th program I have recorded about the war following the fascist coup in Ukraine. And it is impossible, given the breadth of events and the historical depth that is necessary to properly understand them, to do justice to the topic past the point in a single broadcast. All of the other 10 programs are archived, plus the long article-length descriptions and meticulously annotated descriptions of the other programs are available on the Spitfire list .com website. That website contains my entire life's work for download for free. Frequently, the descriptions for the shows contain information that I did not have time for in the original program. That will probably be the case in this program as well. The description is already written and will be up shortly. The title of the program, Walking the Snake, is a reference to the book Serpent's Walk, published by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the top American Nazi group, by the way, formerly represented by Glenn Greenwald when he was an attorney. In that book, the SS goes underground, which is true. They build up their economic muscle, which is true. And they begin buying into the opinion-forming media, which, as we have seen in conjunction with Bertelsmann, also appears to be true. And then they are able to shift public opinion in the United States in a pro-Nazi direction. After a series, they infiltrate the army, the military in general, after a series of terrorist incidents with weapons of mass destruction. Martial law is declared, and the SS basically takes over the United States. The back cover of Serpent's Walk reads as follows. It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and equality. And the way they do that is described in one exchange between a couple of Nazis in the book, and the process is described as follows on pages 42 through 44. Hell, if you can con Granny into buying, and I'm going to paraphrase, one type of breakfast cereal over another, then why can't you swing public opinion over to a cause as vital and important as ours? In any case, we're slowly replacing those negative images with others, the good-bad guy routine. What do you think of Jesse James, John Dillinger, Julius Caesar, Genghis Khan? The reality may have been rough, but there's a sort of glitter about most of these dudes. Mean honchos, but respectable. It's all how you package it. Opinion is a goddamn commodity. It works with anybody. Give it time. Aside from the media, we've been buying up private schools and helping some public ones through philanthropic foundations and working on the churches and the born-agains. Now, cut to the present. After Ukrainian government forces took over the city of Slovyansk, S-L-O-V-Y-A-N-S-K, in the eastern Ukraine, we are left to a tweet by a BBC journalist to find out part of the aftermath. And in that tweet, the BBC journalist Will Vernon on July 7th of 2014 noted that the privisector Ukrainian insurgent black and red flag was flying from the Interior Ministry building in Slovyansk today. Dangerous and worrying. Again, that a tweet from a BBC journalist named Will Vernon. Haven't heard too much about that, of course. Private sector is one of the OUNB successor organizations that came to power in Ukraine. Its head, a guy named Dmitry Yarosh, was the deputy head of the Ukrainian National Security and Defense Council. One of the stunning things is how we are basically being presented with an Orwellian slash Serpent's Walk scenario. That's why I call this show Walk the Snake in Ukraine. Listen to this section of an article from the New York Times, also from that same day, July 7th of 2014. It's an article by David M. Herzenzorn, H-E-R-S-Z-E-N-H-O-R-N, one of the worst of the propagandists masquerading as a journalist for the New York Times. This article, his articles have been outrageous. This is an example. It's headlined, Ukraine military finds its footing against pro-Russian rebels, and it reads in part, now this is a direct quote from Andriy Paruby, A-N-D-R-I-Y, P-A-R-U-B-I-Y. He is the head of the Ukrainian National Defense and Security Council. He also is a charter member of Svoboda. That is another of the OUNB successor organizations in Ukraine, basically an heir to the Ukrainian Nazis that were allied with the Third Reich in World War II. And he is quoted at length and as an authoritative source. Skipping down in the article, quote, I am convinced that there are many other countries which are not ready, properly speaking. Their armed forces are not ready, are unprepared for this type of war, unquote, Mr. Paruby said in an interview last week. We, of course, studied the experience of both Croatia and Israel, but here a lot of new features are added. And if Russia sees this experience as is successful, this experience can very easily be used in any Baltic countries and even in Belarus and Kazakhstan. Mr. Paruby invoked Igor Girkin, G-I-R-K-I-N, an alleged Russian military intelligence officer who has been a commander of the insurrection in eastern Ukraine under the name of Igor Strelkov. By the way, I interjected, alleged. He certainly has a background, but whether he's active duty is simply a matter of conjecture. Quote, if we do not stop Putin here, Mr. Paruby said, nobody knows where his gherkins will appear next, unquote. In the interview, Mr. Paruby laid his hands on the table and, exhaling in disgust, described the paralysis of the initial response to the insurgency. The key tactic of Russian saboteurs is capture a building, station an armed garrison there, and have a picket around mostly communists who would provide a human shield, he said, offering an example he witnessed. They had it this way in Luhansk. There is a five-story building where each window is a firing spot, and right next to the building are 500 people, a picket. When we tell Alpha, a special unit of the SBU whose purpose is to fight terrorists, to enter the building and conduct the operation, they tell us, quote, take away the people because the operation can only be conducted when we are able to enter without a scuffle with civilians, he said. When we tell the interior troops to make a corridor and drag away civilians, they say, quote, how can we do that when terrorists in windows point guns at us? We are not able to fulfill this task, unquote. The military was so underfinanced that the government issued a plea for donations from citizens. Some of the country's richest businessmen used their personal fortunes to create militias that are now effectively part of a new National Guard. As one colleague from the United States said, we have to repair a plane during flight, unquote, Mr. Paruby said. We're going to talk about the downing of Flight 17 later in the program. Nowhere here will you get any idea who Andriy Paruby is or his overt, explicit Nazi affiliation. The militias he refers to here are culled from Svoboda and from Pravi Sektor. Svoboda's combat wing is called C-14 or Combat 14. It refers to these 14 words. We must secure the existence of the white race and a future for our children, unquote. That was minted by David Lane of the American neo-Nazi group, The Order. And they were he built the getaway car for the people who killed Denver talk show host Alan Berg. And the model for their activities was the book The Turner Diaries, published by the same National Vanguard, National Alliance publisher, as Serpent's Walk. So basically what we have in effect is we have the New York Times basically presenting the milieu of David Lane as authoritative political and military commentators. A somewhat, again, there's no critical distance here at all, somewhat deeper analysis was presented by Dina Newman, N-E-W-M-A-N, of BBC News, in July 16th of 2014. Now, we noted that the Pravi Sektor flag was flying over the Interior Ministry in Slovyansk after its capture by government forces. We're going to see a reason for that, I think, and that will be more clearly understood as you listen to this. The appearance of far-right activists, both foreign and homegrown, among the Ukrainian volunteers fighting in East Ukraine is causing unease. That's the subhead. I would note here, in For the Record 779 and 780, we noted that large numbers of Swedish neo-Nazis, among others, were decamping to the Ukraine to fight against pro-Russian forces. That is the same Swedish fascist milieu that has been bankrolled in part by Carl Lundstrom, whose Pirate Bay server, basically on whose Pirate Bay server Julian Assange's WikiLeaks operation held forth. And that arrangement was made by Joran Jermas, a.k.a. Israel Shamir, the Holocaust denier and close Assange aide. I would also note in passing that the Ukrainian coup was financed in part by Pierre Omidyar, the linchpin, the kingpin of eBay, who has also financed Glenn Greenwald's journalistic efforts as of late. And again, Greenwald represented the National Alliance pro bono for a time in his previous incarnation as an attorney. Greenwald was something of a neo-Nazi fellow traveler. This article, again, talking about one of the Swedish neo-Nazis who is now in the Ukraine. Ukraine Conflict, White Power Warrior from Sweden by Dina Newman, BBC, 7/16/2014. Michael Skillet, S-K-I-L-L-I-T, is a Swedish sniper with 7 years' experience in the Swedish Army and the Swedish National Guard. He is currently fighting with the Azov Battalion, that's A-Z-O-V, a pro-Ukrainian volunteer group in eastern Ukraine. He is known to be dangerous to the rebels. Reportedly, there is a bounty of nearly 5,150 euros or $7,000 on his head. In a telephone conversation from an undisclosed location, Mr. Skilt told me more about his duties. Quote, I have at least three purposes in the Azov Battalion. I am a commander of a small reconnaissance unit. I am also a sniper. And sometimes I work as a special coordinator for clearing houses and going into civilian areas, unquote. As to his political views, Mr. Skilt prefers to call himself a nationalist, but in fact his views are typical of a neo-Nazi. It's all about, now compare his next statement with the back of Serpent's Walk that I read earlier. Listen very carefully. It's all about how you see it, he says. I would be an idiot if I said I did not want to see the survival of the white people. After World War II, the victors wrote their history. They decided that it's always a bad thing to say I am white and I am proud. Mr. Skilt believes that races should not mix. He says the Jews are not white and should not mix with white people. His next project is to go fight for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad because he believes Mr. Assad is standing up to international Zionism. Skipping down. Mr. Skilt says there is only a handful of foreign fighters in the Azov Battalion, and they do not get paid. They see it as a good thing to come and fight, he explains. However, Mr. Skilt is expecting more foreigners to join soon. He says there is now a recruiter who is looking for, quote, serious fighters, unquote, from outside Ukraine. The key figures in the Azov battalion are its commander, Andrei Beletsky, and his deputy, Ihor Mosychuk. By the way, I may be mispronouncing that. M-O-S-I-Y-C-H-U-K. In fact, I may be mispronouncing many of these Ukrainian names. Beginning again, the key figures in the Azov battalion are its commander, Andrei Beletsky, and his deputy, Ihor Mosychuk. Andrei Beletsky is also the leader of a Ukrainian organization called the Social National Assembly. Its aims are stated in one of their online publications: to prepare Ukraine for further expansion and to struggle for the liberation of the entire white race from the domination of the internationalist speculative capital, unquote. To punish severely sexual perversions and any interracial contacts that lead to the extinction of the white man, unquote. This, according to experts, is a typical neo-Nazi narrative. The Azov battalion was formed and armed by Ukraine's Interior Ministry. A ministerial advisor, Anton Gerashenko, got angry when I asked him if the battalion had any neo-Nazi links through the Social National Assembly. The Social National Assembly is not a neo-Nazi organization, he said. It is a party of Ukrainian patriots who are giving their lives while the rich Europeans are only talking about supporting Ukraine. When, may I ask, will English people come here and help us fight terrorists sent by Russia's President Putin instead of lecturing us on our moral values or people's political affiliations? Mr. Gerashenko was adamant, however, that there were no foreign citizens fighting in the Azov battalion. There are foreign journalists from Sweden, Spain, and Italy who have come to report on the heroic achievements of the fighters in their struggle against terrorism, he said. He insisted he had never heard of Michael Skilt, the Swedish sniper. By the way, I aired the man's name, S-K-I-L-L-T. The reality of what is going on in Ukraine and against which, the background of which, the MH17 flight was brought down, and I do not know who brought it down, but the background is as follows. This from the Pando Daily of July 3rd of 2014. This is called The Fog of Twitter, Ukraine's Civil War and the Limits of Social News Gathering by Yasha Levine. It reads in part, just in case you missed it, there's a real effing civil war raging in eastern Ukraine. On July 2nd, the day after elected billionaire President Petro Poroshenko called off a ceasefire, residential areas in several towns and villages in the Luhansk and Donetsk regions came under intense shelling and air bombardment. The town of Slavyansk, which has seen a lot of fighting, was shelled. The Ukrainian Air Force bombed the village of Stanitsa Luhanska. The attack obliterated an entire residential area, shredding houses, people, and pets, and littering the area with pieces of intestines, toes, and cats. Yes, dead kitties. There are several very graphic videos of the aftermath, faces of death, delivered to YouTube for global viewing within a few dozen minutes of it happening. Here's one of the less graphic videos from the strike on Stanitsa Luhanska, where at least 10 people were killed and many more injured, skipping down. But you wouldn't know any of this from the U.S. news media, which has been soft-censoring and whitewashing anything that could show the Ukrainian government in a bad light from the very beginning of the conflict. The New York Times alluded to yesterday's ground assaults and air bombardments, unquote, and mumbled something about civilian casualties, unquote, but made it unclear who was doing the shooting or the dying. Other newspapers are equally mum on Ukraine's attack on Ukrainian civilians. Meanwhile, U.S. cable network news pretends that none of this even exists. For its part, the U.S. State Department praised Ukraine's restraint, unquote, and accused Russia of exaggerating, if not being behind, the attacks on civilians. So again, it is against the background of this warfare that the downing of the plane took place. A couple of very quick points. The plane was at 33,000 feet when it was brought down. No aircraft are allowed to fly from 32,000 feet down. Why it was that close to the proscribed area and flying through a war zone where not only was there aerial warfare but anti-aircraft warfare going down is a question our media have not asked. The realities of what is really going on there were also portrayed very accurately in an article that appeared in The Nation magazine of June 30th of 2014. This article is called The Silence of American Hawks About Kiev's Atrocities. It's by Stephen F. Cohen, and it reads in part as follows. The Ukrainian regime has repeatedly carried out artillery and air attacks on city centers, creating a humanitarian catastrophe, which is all but ignored by the U.S. political media establishment. For weeks, the U.S.-backed regime in Kiev has been committing atrocities against its own citizens in southeastern Ukraine, regions heavily populated by Russian-speaking Ukrainians and ethnic Russians, while victimizing a growing number of innocent people, including children, and degrading America's reputation. These military assaults on cities captured on video are generating pressure in Russia on President Vladimir Putin to, quote, save our compatriots, unquote. The reaction of the Obama administration, as well as the new Cold War hawks in Congress and in the establishment media, has been twofold. Silence, interrupted only by occasional statement excusing and thus encouraging more atrocities by Kiev. Very few Americans, notably the independent scholar Gordon Hahn, have protested this shameful complicity. We may honorably disagree about the causes and resolution of the Ukrainian crisis, the worst U.S.-Russian confrontation in decades, but not about deeds that are rising to the level of war crimes if they have not already done so. Then after describing the Euromaidan coup, which was actually the result of a $5 billion covert operation by the U.S. and God knows how much money from other Western countries. The article goes on to say as follows, skipping down, considering those preceding events, but above all the country's profound historical divisions, particularly between its eastern and western regions, ethnic, linguistic, religious, cultural, economic, and political, the rebellion in the southeast, centered in the industrial Donbass, D-O-N-B-A-S-S, was not surprising, nor were its protests against the unconstitutional way, in effect, the coup that the new government had come to power. The Southeast's sudden loss of effective political representation in the capital and the real prospect of official discrimination also gave rise to the rebellion. But by declaring an anti-terrorist operation against the new protesters, Kiev signaled its intention to, quote, destroy, unquote, them, not negotiate with them. On May 2nd, in this incendiary atmosphere, a horrific event occurred in the southern city of Odessa, awakening memories of Nazi German extermination squads in Ukraine and other Soviet republics during World War II. An organized pro-Kiev mob chased protesters into a building, set it on fire, and tried to block the exits. By the way, compare this to what Andrei Parubiy was quoted as saying by David M. Hershenson in that naked propaganda disguise of journalism. Beginning again. An organized pro-Kiev mob chased protesters into a building, set it on fire, and tried to block the exits. Some 40 people, perhaps many more, perished in the flames or were murdered as they fled the inferno. A still unknown number of other victims were seriously injured. Members of the infamous Right Sector, a far-right paramilitary organization ideologically aligned with the ultra-nationalist Svoboda Party, itself a constituent part of Kiev's coalition government, led the mob. both are frequently characterized by knowledgeable observers as neo-fascist movements. Hateful ethnic chants by the mob were audible, and swastika-like symbols and SS symbols were found on the scorched building. Kiev alleged that the victims had themselves accidentally started the fire, but eyewitnesses, television footage, and social media videos told the true story, as they have about subsequent atrocities. Instead of interpreting the Odessa massacre as an imperative for restraint, Kiev intensified its, quote, anti-terrorist operation, unquote. Since May, the regime has sent a growing number of armored personnel carriers, tanks, artillery, helicopter gunships, and warplanes to southeastern cities, among them Slovyansk, Mariupol, Krasno-Armaysk, Kramatorsk, Donetsk, and Luhansk. When its regular military units and local police forces turned out to be less than effective, willing, or loyal, Kiev hastily mobilized right sector and other radical nationalist militias responsible for much of the violence at Maidan into a National Guard to accompany regular detachments, partly to reinforce them, partly, it seems, to enforce Kiev's commands. Zealous, barely trained, and drawn mostly from central and western regions, Kiev's new recruits have reportedly escalated the ethnic warfare and killing of innocent civilians. Episodes described as massacres soon also occurred in Mariupol and Kramatorsk. By the way, we talked about that in For the Record 794, the fires this time. Continuing. Initially, the anti-terrorist, unquote, campaign was limited primarily, though not only, to rebel checkpoints on the outskirts of cities. Since May, however, Kiev has repeatedly carried out artillery and air attacks on city centers that have struck residential buildings, shopping malls, parks, schools, kindergartens, and hospitals, particularly in Slovyansk and Luhansk. More and more urban areas, neighboring towns, and even villages now look and sound like war zones with telltale rubble, destroyed and pockmarked buildings, mangled vehicles, the dead and wounded in the streets, wailing mourners, and crying children. Skipping down. The number continues to grow due also to Kiev's blockade of cities where essential medicines, food, water, fuel, and electricity are scarce, and where wages and pensions are often no longer being paid. The result is an emerging humanitarian catastrophe. Another effect is clear. Kiev's anti-terrorist, unquote, tactics have created a reign of terror in the targeted cities. Panicked by shells and mortars exploding on the ground, menacing helicopters and attack planes flying above, and fear of what may come next, families are seeking sanctuary in basements and other darkened shelters. And we're going to continue with this analysis in side two of the program. Again, I can't even begin to do justice to the previous 10 programs about Ukraine. Those are all archived in audio, and the long article-length descriptions are archived in the For the Record section of the SpitfireList.com website, which has my entire life's work and a small library of anti-fascist books for download for free at SpitfireList.com. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 803, Walking the Snake in Ukraine. This is being recorded on July 27th of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.